know, lurking behind many of the conversations we have here on Issues Etc., issues of abortion, divorce, marriage, family, all of those issues deal in one way or another with one that we're going to talk about here in the first half hour of the program. Feminism, but in particular feminism as it was embodied at the very beginning of its radical movement by one Betty Friedan. She died at 85, and we're going to be talking about her, hearing a little bit here in the first few minutes, a CNN biography retrospective piece on Friedan, and then Carolyn Graglia joins us to talk about Friedan, her legacy. She died on Saturday. Carolyn is the author of the classic book, Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. That'll be the first half hour of the program. In the second half hour, Brian Gadawa joins us. The Oscar nominations came out late last week. We're going to be talking about the big Oscar names, the actors, and also the movies with Brian Gadawa, screenwriter in Southern California. From 4 to 5, we've got a sermon review today. Good old Joel Osteen will review one of his. He's going to be talking about improving your self-image. This is Osteen at his most word faith, at his most prosperity gospel so far. We'll be hearing the sermon, reviewing it during the second hour of the program. Then, from 5 o'clock until 5:30, Dr. Uwe Simonetto joins us. We're going to continue our series on lay vocation, vocation of the media, in light of the current riots in Islamic countries over the publication of a cartoon in a Danish newspaper, a rather obscure Danish newspaper, allegedly depicting Mohammed as a terrorist. Well, Beirut is in flames over this and other things. Uwe will join us in that half hour to talk about that. And then in the last half hour, something we didn't get to last week, Rudolph Giuliani is a very possible presidential contender for the Republican Party in 2008. We'll talk about Giuliani for president, and as time permits, maybe talk a little bit about this high court case in Kansas. Barring information passing from abortion clinics to prosecutors when it comes to statutory rape, and then, again, if time permits, also an NPR piece on this girl who was going to have the plug pulled, 11 years old, in a irreversible coma that reversed itself. And right after the court decided to pull the plug, she got better. We'll talk about that in the last half hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Before we bring on Carolyn Graglia, first let's hear this retrospective piece of biography from CNN on the late Betty Friedan.
In 1963, when Betty Friedan wrote her revolutionary book, The Feminine Mystique, describing entrapped housewives, it became a catalyst for what was to become the feminine movement, and she, its spokesperson.
In my gut, I knew that it was important, but that the book itself would help bring about the consciousness that led to the women's movement. No, I couldn't possibly have predicted that.
Although she didn't predict it, her book was a rallying cry, a call to action.
Equal pay for equal work, join our crowd!
To help fight for that equality, Friedan founded the National Organization for Women in 1966, now lobbied for and won laws that guaranteed equal pay for equal work.
She opened the doors for women to do whatever we could do as individuals.
Betty is the reason that most of us have our jobs right now.
In 1993, Friedan wrote The Fountain of Age. This was her attempt to liberate the elderly from nursing homes the way she had liberated women from the kitchen.
We are the first ones to have 25 years, 30 years of possibly healthy, vigorous, vital life after we're 50. And that new third of life, see, that's the unmapped territory.
She lived her life as she advised others to. Productively. Born Betty Naomi Goldstein on February 4, 1921, in Peoria, Illinois, she went on to marry and have three children. In 1969, after 22 years of marriage, she and husband Carl divorced. She became an intellectual vagabond, traveling the world to fight for women's issues.
This is the only place in the world where women's concerns, women's move to equality, women's access to technology are being debated.
Friedan divided her time between her her Manhattan apartment, a Long Island house, and a California condo. She taught and created a think tank focusing on a variety of social issues. She also wrote books and magazine articles and even had time to be very social. Her influence was felt by women in all walks of life.
I thank Ms. Friedan for the shocking freedom with which I've been able to move through my life with female courage and female strength and female outspokenness.
Friedan said witnessing her mother's frustration led to her life's work.
I feel an ongoing commitment to the women's movement, which I helped start and which I think has been enormously liberating for women.
Her goal, she said, was to make women feel better about being women.
All right, that piece comes from CNN, a retrospective on Betty Friedan, who died on Saturday at 85. Carolyn Graglia joins us for the remainder of this segment. She received her degree in law from Columbia University in the 1950s as she left a promising career in a prominent Washington law firm to care for her husband and three children. She's author of the book Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. Carolyn, welcome back.
It's very good to be back.
So how would you describe the legacy of Betty Friedan?
Well, I think the legacy is a lot worse than what she started out to do.
Oh, really?
Well, that is, Betty Friedan wrote a book, and she said a lot of horrible things in the book about the value of the homemaker. But what happened was that the media just lionized her. And I think that she never expected that she would have had the influence that she ended up having. And in that sense, I say the legacy is worse than what she really intended. I don't think she ever thought that she would become the focus of media attention. And I don't think she ever predicted in the beginning that her ideas would become institutionalized within the fabric of our society. And I think it's fair to say that because of her founding of the contemporary feminist movement, our society has been changed in more ways than over a few decades than ever happened during any other period in the society.
Well, Carolyn, if we could look back at the feminine mystique without the lens of modern radical feminism in the way, but look at kind of the quote-unquote innocent beginnings with Friedan's work that
right.
that launched the firestorm. What did she originally intend to say, and what was the message of that book?
Well, what she wanted to say was that women have made a mistaken choice. At the time that she wrote, we had a greater number of women staying home to raise children than we had had in the period from the 1920s through to the 1950s. Particularly in the 1930s and 1940s, you had a lot of career women. And if you look back at the movies that showed you career women. And I know that when I was a young girl shopping in stores, which would have been in the early 1940s, all the dress departments I go to would say career dressing. Well, then, although women were still getting an education, so many of them decided that what they wanted to do was stay home and raise their children. And this shocked Betty Friedan. And what she wrote in the book was, why is it that although so many women are getting excellent educations, fewer of them are practicing what they had learned, fewer of them are pursuing careers than pursued careers in the 1930s and 1940s. And she said the reason is that they have become convinced that they are indispensable in the home, that the most important thing is the home, the family, and raising your own children. She said what they have to do is see that the lives they are living are worthless, that what counts is what is done in the workplace, and they have to go out and pursue careers as men do. She said they have to juggle their pregnancies, hire nannies and housekeepers, and go to work. That was the message of the book. There was not a word in that book about the fact that women were being discriminated against and couldn't get jobs. She said, why is it that all the barriers to their employment and their successful pursuit of careers have been removed, and yet they're still staying home? And she said that's because they believe in this, what she called the feminine mystique, that the most important thing in life was your family and your children.
Well, it just strikes me, the parallel with that time today, as it's been noted by many, including yourself, Carolyn, young women, well-educated, well-trained, perfectly serviceable in any kind of career, many of them, more and more of them, are deciding to stay home.
Absolutely. Now, I have finally lived long enough to see it go full circle. And I think I'm very grateful that I have been able to see this. The day it was in September, last September, when the New York Times on the front page had the article that said, many women at elite colleges set career path to motherhood. And I put the paper in front of my husband and I said, look, but of course, it's going to be hard for them. It is going to be hard, and the reason it's going to be hard is because society has changed so much as a result of what the feminist movement accomplished. Because when I decided to stop working and stay home and raise a family, we had much better divorce laws than we have today. No-fault divorce has been instituted throughout the country, so that these women are taking a chance when they stay home, a chance that I didn't take at the time. It eventually became a more perilous situation for me, but it wasn't because I was married to an honorable man. But these women, and when they leave their jobs to stay home, they're taking a chance because of no-fault divorce laws, and that's the result of the feminist movement, because they fought for those laws. There's another problem today that they're facing, and that is that some studies show that 66% of men say they expect their wives to work. And so they may decide, oh, I don't want to put this baby in daycare. I want to stay home. And they're faced with a husband who says, well, wait a minute. I have to pay the mortgage all by myself without your help. And this is a serious problem that is going to have to be faced by all these women. But at least we now have a situation where a number of women are finding husbands who are willing to take over the breadwinner role, and they are leaving the workplace. And that's a good thing.
So you spoke earlier about those societal changes and her ideas that eventually, perhaps even beyond her expectation, have become institutionalized, no-fault divorce, the mentality that women have an obligation to work outside the home, the restructuring of the family economics so that women have to work outside the home. What other institutional changes have taken place in society as a result of Friedan's ideas?
Well, there have been so many of them. We now have in place preferential treatment of women in the workplace. On the one hand, you have some women now saying, gee, I want a husband who can support me, but we have laws which give preferences to women. For example, all contract set-asides, all states now, all cities, federal government says a certain number of contracts must be let. Without looking at the level of the bidding, they've done away with competitive bidding on a certain percentage of contracts so that they go to female-headed businesses. Well, this is a huge change, and those laws should be changed so that you have a level playing field. we have in place government subsidizations of daycare, for example, which mean that one-income families are actually earning less. The breadwinner in a one-income family is earning less in order to subsidize daycare for two-income families. Things like that people aren't even aware of, but they are definitely making it difficult for one-income families. There are so many times in the course of a day, in the course of meeting people or in the reading that she does, where a woman who does not work realizes that there is still a stigma on not working. And I call it marginalizing the homemaker. This makes it very difficult for some women to stop working. As one writer has written, it used to be that there was a stigma of being an old maid. And he says, in recent years, under the aegis of feminist indoctrination, there's a stigma on not having a job. And we do have to change that.
We're talking with Carolyn Graglia about the legacy of Betty Friedan. Friedan died last Saturday. Carolyn received her law degree from Columbia University in the 1950s, left a promising career in a prominent Washington law firm to care for her husband and three children. She is author of the classic book Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org, and our call-in numbers 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Coming up here in about 10 minutes, we'll discuss the Oscar nominations from last week with Brian Gadawa. Carolyn, what's been the effect on children? We talk about the family kind of in a general way, but what's been the effect upon children in the Friedan legacy that's become radical feminism?
Well, what has happened to children is incredibly sad, because we now have a society in which half of all marriages end in divorce, and only 50% of children reach adulthood with a biological father in the home. Now, studies show that any woman who works 80% of the time after her first child is born is twice as likely to divorce as women who do not work. And because so many women have been working, and because of the institution of no-fault divorce, we have so many children growing up without a father in the home. And this has been devastating for children. I mean, we get study after study coming out. A most recent one was by a woman, Elizabeth Margaret. And she shows how devastating divorce is for children. And the results of this just spread throughout the culture, because divorce is probably harder on boys than on girls. And we know boys growing up without a father in the home are twice as likely to spend time in prison. Boys are achieving at much lower levels now than girls. And probably a large part of the explanation for that is the fact that they're growing up without fathers in the homes. And some of the statistics on that are really frightening, because at the present time, entering freshman classes in college are only 42% male. And it's going to decline to 40%, they predict, very quickly. At the present time, 70% of students in veterinary school are female. Females have been more than half of the entering classes in law school now since 2001. So where are women who decide they want to stay home going to find the men who have the education to support them? We cannot continue in this path and hope that we can maintain traditional families.
One of the things that I think now it's so ingrained in our way of thinking, Carolyn, that it hardly sounds like an objection. It just sounds axiomatic that a young lady who would go and get a perfectly good university education and then spend the major part of the rest of her life until the kids are raised at home with the kids, taking care of husband and family, is wasting that education. That seems axiomatic nowadays, the way we think. How
well,
do you respond
to it?
Well,
it certainly does. And that is one of the things. I get letters all the time from women who have read my book, and they'll often write to me and say, I would love to stay home with my children, and my husband says I'll be wasting my education. Well, my answer to that always is education is never wasted. The more education you have, I think the more exciting you can make a life, even the life at home. You bring so much more to your daily activities with your children and the activities that you do in the community. The problem is that we have become such a materialistic society that the only rewards that many people think of are the monetary rewards. What is the monetary reward for your education? And when you think that way, unless you are pursuing a career using the education, you've wasted it. But if you think in terms of, as I do, what's the most important thing in your life? And for me, that was interaction with my children and with my husband. Now my children are all grown up, and I interact with them less often and with the grandchildren. But for all those years, that was the most important thing. And if I was a more interesting person to talk to my husband at night about things, it made his life more interesting with me, and that to me is reason enough for an education. He could come home and talk about what was going on in the field of law. I could remember it. I could read about it and discuss it. And that was enough.
Carolyn Graglia received her law degree from Columbia University in the 1950s. She left a promising career in a prominent Washington law firm to care for her husband and three children. She's the author of the book Domestic Tranquility, A Brief Against Feminism. You can find out more about this book, Domestic Tranquility, at www.spencepublishing.com or by calling Spence Publishing toll-free, 1-888-SPENPUB, 1-888-SPENPUB. Carolyn, thanks for being our guest.
Well, I certainly enjoyed it.
When we come back from this break, last week the Oscar nominations were out, and they interested a lot of people, not a lot of box office in those big nominations. Some controversy, maybe a common thread running through them. When we come back, we're going to be talking with Brian Gadawa, a screenwriter from Southern California, about the Oscar nominations. Walk through that until the end of the first hour. In the second hour of the program, we'll be reviewing one of Joel Osteen's sermon, his latest, from Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, on improving your self-image. He has a very, very simple recipe. It is stop saying negative things about yourself, start saying positive things about yourself, and like the wagon following the oxen, your life will turn around. You'll improve things for yourself. And then, in the third hour of the program, Dr. Uwe Simonetto joins us to talk about the Beirut mobs and why they are upset about a cartoon. Stay tuned. The Oscars are next.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Among the most difficult books of the Old Testament is that of the prophet Ezekiel. Yes, Ezekiel's visions and oracles are difficult to understand, yet their message is nothing else than Scripture's message, the message of law and gospel, sin and grace, death and new life. Can the book of Ezekiel be read in a Christ-centered, cross-focused way? Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February is the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel chapters 1 through 20. This book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling. For more information, visit our website, issuesetc.org. Look for the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel. Or call Concordia Publishing House any weekday during regular business hours. Their number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Ask for the Issues Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, chapters 1 through 20.
Teaching about one of the world's most serious health problems paves a way to sharing Christ. This Global Minute lets you hear exciting news from the mission agency, Operation Mobilization. In countries where concern is growing over deaths related to AIDS, missionaries with Operation Mobilization are teaching families about AIDS and then showing them how to prevent the disease from spreading in the community. The teaching effort is underway in Central Asia, where Christians aren't allowed to openly share their faith or openly evangelize. However, as discussions over the disease become deeply personal, the conversation turns to Christ's hope. This is only one example of how Christians can use their skills around the globe for God's glory. Pray for more Christians in health and other fields to step forward. See exciting opportunities around the globe. Log on to www.usa.om.org. usa.om.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Congratulations to the Pittsburgh Steelers for winning the Super Bowl. Would it have turned out differently if Jesus had been playing for the Seattle Seahawks? Imagine the announcers. Jesus drops back and uncorks a long pass. Look, Jesus sped downfield and caught his own pass. Touchdown! Or how about this? Only 6 seconds left in the game, and the Seahawks are deep in their own territory. What's this? Jesus is going to attempt a field goal? The ball is snapped. Jesus kicks, and a miracle! The ball goes through the uprights. Jesus kicked a 90-yard field goal! Could Jesus have played last night and been on the losing side? Could he have thrown a pass and been intercepted? Yes. A sports loss, a miscalculated play, is not sin. Sin is our inborn rebellion against God. Jesus is the Son of God and also a true human being, not a Superman. Bullets did not bounce off him. Nails pierced him. Hebrews 4:15 says, He has been tempted in every way, just as we are, yet was without sin. Life is not a Super Bowl party, and we often find ourselves on the losing side. He's one of us, yet without sin. Jesus can sit down with you, sympathize with you in your problems, and assure you that he's won the ultimate victory for you.
The George O. White State Forest Nursery offers Missouri residents tree and shrub seedlings for reforestation, windbreaks, erosion control, and wildlife food and cover. Choose from 70 species, plus special bundles, like the conservation bundle, perfect for adding a mix of trees and shrubs to your property. There's also wildlife cover, walnut variety, and quail cover bundles. Orders are filled on a first-come, first-served basis while quantities last. For details and an order form, log on to MissouriConservation.org, keyword seedlings.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Brian Gadawa is our guest for this 25 minutes. We'll talk about the Oscar nominations. You know, I don't expect a movie like King Kong to get an Oscar nomination. I said this before when we were talking about the Oscars. It's a movie that's going to make a ton of money. And it's a movie that is very entertaining and seen by a lot of people. But it's not Oscar material. I mean, it could be, I guess, but it isn't Oscar material. Not for things like Best Picture, Best Actor, Supporting Actor, things like that. So, that's a different thing from looking at the Oscar nominations. Brokeback Mountain, Capote, Crash, Good Night and Good Luck, Munich. I think one of them made $50 million. That's odd. So why so little box office and so much acclaim by the Oscar nominators? We'll be talking about that and each one of those movies here in this 25 minutes of Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in numbers, if you'd like to join us, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, you can shoot us an email right here in the studio. We'll get it and respond to your question or your comment in real time. Issuesetc at kfuo.org. Brian Gadawa is a regular guest. He's a screenwriter in Southern California and has authored the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. Brian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
Well, were you surprised by Best Motion Picture nominations this time in the Oscar, in the nominee round of this event that takes place in Hollywood?
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, I was, actually. Well, I was, but I wasn't. You know, Hollywood has seemed to be getting more and more political over the years, and so excuse me, I have something in my throat. And so consequently, in that sense, I kind of expect it. And in another sense, though, the movies that are up, I don't think all of them are really worthy of being up there, you know.
Just if you could, give us a bit of an insider's explanation on what the Oscars are intended to be and how a movie gets nominated. This all seems like voodoo to me. And then eventually how those nominees, one of them at least in each category, turns into an actual award.
Oops. Unfortunately, I don't know much about that.
It's as much voodoo to you as it is to me?
Yeah, I tend to not care too much about that, but unfortunately,
okay.
I can't.
Then why do Oscars matter to Hollywood?
Well, you know, as Michael Medved has often pointed out, Hollywood is driven. Yes, there's segments of Hollywood that is driven by money, but that's not really the overall most dominant or only driving force. It's driven a lot by peer acceptance and, you know, fame, which is basically acceptance and adulation, which involves peer acceptance. But one of the things that Medved has pretty much proven in his previous books, like Hollywood versus America, is that according to the awards that you see that are won for movies that do terrible at the box office, et cetera, and that they keep making these movies, you know, Hollywood people are driven by peer acceptance, and the Oscars are the ultimate peer acceptance. So that's why you have someone like Sally Field crying and saying, "You like me," you know. But the reality is that, over time, as people follow it, even though we gripe and complain, you know, we still end up going out and ultimately seeing movies that 20 years ago we would have, you know, scoffed at. For example, Brokeback Mountain. I mean, 15 years ago, a movie, especially a mainstream movie about it, a homosexual romance, would have been laughed out of the town. And yet now, it's up for an Oscar. But more than that, a lot of people are seeing it.
Okay, tell us about the movie Brokeback Mountain. I mean, there have been, it began almost from the very moment it hit the screens to kind of stir jokes in the late night talk circuit and things like that.
Sure.
But what is the film about, and why do you think it garnered the most nominations?
Well, the film is basically about a story about two young men who are literally cowboys. They go and take care of, you know, sheep out on the range or whatever. That's how they get employed, even though it's takes place in the 60s. And so they go out to work together, and they eventually fall in lust with one another, homosexual lust, and engage in homosexual behavior. But then they go back because it's just a summer job, and they live their lives, and then they, because they're pressured by society around them, they both get married because that's the right thing to do. But all through the years, like, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 years or something, these men occasionally get together and have their sexual romps out in the woods. And the whole point of the story is to try to normalize homosexuality as a legitimate means of love and romance over a long period of time. Of course, what it really is it is a brilliant form of propaganda. What the movie does is it subversively undermines the dominant male myth in America, which is what? The cowboy. The cowboy is the dominant American myth of male, you know, whatever, whether it's roughness, you know, manliness, et cetera, et cetera. This is why cigarettes did so well, Marlboro did so well, using the cowboy subversively to support cigarette selling. That was also propaganda. And so the movie does that in a brilliant way. It takes very popular actors, Jake Gyllenhaal and Heath Ledger, places them in a mainstream movie about homosexual romance. And in so doing, that softens people to be willing to at least consider it and watch it, because, hey, after all, these are great actors, and this is not some weird offshoot movie, right? So, but the fact that they could get made and that people are seeing it just shows you what's happened over a period of 10, 15 years as the homosexual lobby in Hollywood has sought to normalize homosexuality by making positive homosexual characters in TV shows, forcing people never to be negative about homosexuals, you know, who was the guy? I can't remember one of the bigwigs, Michael Ovitz, who got attacked for pointing out that there's a gay police, you know, gay mafia going around. And the fact is that's true. You know, that's there. And so over time, it's become more acceptable to see homosexuality as an alternative lifestyle rather than an alternative death style, which is what it really is.
I mean, this picture, I mean, someone might say, okay, the primary departure from reality in Brokeback Mountain is that it's two cowboys. But I sense that you would object and say, no, really, the primary departure from reality here is that homosexuality as a lifestyle or a love style or something like that is this kind of long-term romance akin to heterosexual love.
Yeah, that it is different. It is, you know, it's not, it's unique. But and it does show it. You know, in one level, the movie's not a great movie, but it's got some authenticity in showing the struggles that these cowboys go through. But the context of the struggle is, they show that their lives are destroyed, their marriages are destroyed because of their homosexual obsession. But the reality is, the context of the movie is they were forced into those marriages because society would not accept them. And so they had to play along with society's rules. So it's the ultimate victimization game where society, it's the moral people that cause the immorality, you know. And so that, it's again, it's all brilliant storytelling. It's subversion. It's subversion of the, you know, modern ethos in America. And, you know, and then also they make him the ultimate victim. They, you know, one of the guys ends up getting beat up to death for being a homosexual at the end of the movie, and that's supposed to make us feel sorry because look at how intolerant the world is. And, you know, so it takes all the worst and makes them into victims and this kind of thing. And that's the power of storytelling, you know, and that's why, you know, we need to support other movies that do the same thing but support, you know, good values, you know, and good world views like End of the Spear or, you know, Chronicles of Narnia, that kind of thing.
Okay, another film that was in, that's up for Best Picture is Capote. Now, yeah. Biopic, a little bit of history.
Right.
So give us the story of the film and what do you think about it?
Also, a biopic about another famous homosexual. Now, they downplayed homosexuality in the movie, which I think was a smart thing to do. But it's, you know, it's, we know, if you know anything about him and his affect, you know that that's what he is. But it's a brilliant movie, actually. I write about it on my movie blog, which people can go read about. I think that between that movie and Crash, those are the only two on the list that deserve to win the Oscar. Cinderella Man should be on there, and that should probably really win. But anyway, so Capote is the story of the famous writer, you know, back in, oh, gosh, I don't know, what was that, maybe the 50s, and he was the one who wrote the story in cold blood of the killers, you know, who killed the family. And this is the story of him interacting with the killers and writing the book and how that affected him. And ultimately, it's not a flattering portrait of Capote, nor is it a attack piece. It's a pretty fairly balanced portrait of both the good and bad of this man and you know, the negative of what he did and how what he did with his writing in exploiting the killers was really a form of character assassination or character murder himself. And so, in other words, he was sort of a serial killer, you know, spiritually in what he was doing and using people for his purposes. And the movie brings that point out. I thought it was really a very profound piece, actually.
You mentioned there also on this list for Best Picture is Crash.
Yeah.
I rented it when it came out on DVD, and I watched it because it had some big names in it, and I thought the movie was fairly well done. I start looking at reviews of it, and by and large, the critics just absolutely hated this movie.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's good to hear, because I usually hate what the critics say, and so I loved Crash, and I think Crash should win. Crash is what I call a providential ensemble piece, which means it's a story about multiple people's stories who do not really have any connection with each other, but the point of the movie is to show how all their lives intersect in a way providentially that they would not even realize is going on. And these stories takes place in Los Angeles, and they're basically just little individual stories of people dealing with racism in one form or another. And what's so profound and brilliant about the film is it does not take the cliche tack of all the whiteys are racists, you know, and white people are, you know, Caucasians are the problem, and, you know, they hate blacks and all this kind of stuff. That's sort of the typical thing, and that's dealt with. There's a character that has that attitude, but there are also blacks who are racist against whites, Asians who are racist against blacks, blacks who are racist against Asians and Arabs, and it, you know, and it just fills it in how our entire society still has a very hateful, racist attitude, even with people who think they aren't racist and pride themselves on such, like liberals who claim to be, colorblind, but actually they're really not. And at the end of the day, it also points up the fact that racism is not the absolute evil that it's been made out to be in our society, which means people are racist and that's wrong, but the movie shows that even racists can be very heroic people who do good things as well. They're not absolutely evil just because they have a prejudicial attitude. But it also shows that so-called liberal non-racist people can actually do evil deeds. And so it shows the complexity of the issues in a very fair, profound way, and makes everyone, I think, willing to sit up and listen to what the movie has to say and consider your own life in light of that and say, you know, where am I being prejudicial against people before I even know what they're like, you know?
The thing that I found intriguing about the movie was, first of all, it had two scenes in it the one comes near the beginning of the movie. It was a great way to kick off the movie, and that where there are two black guys walking out of a restaurant in kind of a swanky L.A. neighborhood. They're complaining about the treatment they got in the restaurant, I believe.
And how everyone thinks that they're Crips and Bloods just because they dress a certain way and they're black.
And the next thing you know, they whip out huge guns and they carjack somebody. And I thought to myself, now you know, it took me so much by surprise. And the other scene in that film was with the little girl, the Hispanic locksmith's daughter, and the kind of this shooting that takes place near the end, the non-shooting, that I thought was a great way to kind of close the movie as well. And the critics seemed to say that this was just a movie that fed stereotypes.
No, it took the stereotypes that are in the world and fairly dealt with all of them because they're all based on reality. But what makes it non-stereotypical is it dealt with all of them fairly rather than one. You know, when you only deal with one prejudice, then you become more stereotypical. But if you're dealing with all the prejudices, you're actually being more fair and true to what's really going on. Also, I think, like, what you were pointing up to was it deals with self-deception and how we all think of ourselves in one way as, and usually it's good, but we deny our behavior and the way we really treat other people. And that's a powerful moral tale. So yeah, I mean, in many ways, it deals with what would otherwise be stereotypical characters, but because the whole movie is about undermining those stereotypes, then it's not stereotypical. You know, so you have the guy who's dressed up like a gang banger, but he's actually a loving father. That's the opposite of a stereotype. That's actually breaking through the boundaries of stereotypes, you know?
Let's talk a bit about, we've talked about some of those films, like the top three there. Talk a bit about Best Actor and Actress. How do you think that came out?
Oh, I'm absolutely convinced that Brokeback Mountain will win. I mean, look, at last year, you know, a movie about murdering people with euthanasia wins. So, you know, it's going to win, you know. And in terms of the best acting, I was, like, equally confident walking out of Walk the Line that Joaquin Phoenix for his portrayal of Johnny Cash was going to win, but I also, when I saw Capote, I thought, man, he's going to win. So I think he's going to win for Capote, because it was just, those two men inhabited their characters so deeply that it's just been acknowledged on all levels, you know?
Now, on Walk the Line, if I remember correctly reading your review of Walk the Line, you were somewhat critical of the film because you thought it was kind of a two-dimensional depiction of the great man.
Yeah. I mean, I liked it, and I thought it was a well-done movie, but I just felt like it was another subversive capturing of a story of a Christian man and retelling it through humanist eyes. And it's sort of like, you know, stop stealing our stories. Tell your own, you know. Don't take a story about a Christian and, like, totally make it devoid, you know, 98% devoid of his faith, you know. That's part of the struggle, part of the issue. It should have been in there, but it wasn't, and that's what I didn't like about that. But it was still done well, and the part that it did show and deal with in him was a rather, you know, his relationship with his father and his struggles with his family, I thought was a very, you know, deep and moving portrait, actually. And with his, you know, relationship with his wife and his adultery and such and all that, how it affected him, I thought that was really well done.
What about Good Night and Good Luck? This is one of two films, I believe, that George Clooney has had a pretty deep hand in, and this one has to do with radio and early television great Edward R. Murrow.
Yeah, unfortunately, I haven't seen that movie. I just wasn't that interested in the political propaganda of, you know, of that era, because Hollywood so, you know, worships the anti-McCarthyism and much of the facts that they have on McCarthy, although he was certainly no saint, you know, it's all a lot of twisted facts. You know, I would advise people, if you want to hear more of the true story of what happened, read Ann Coulter's book from last year. I think it was Treason, I think it is, and she goes into the details and facts about McCarthy that people don't know about, one of which is the fact that McCarthy, you know, despite his sort of obnoxious personality, wasn't only right, he was not right enough. There were far more communists that were in the government than what he actually thought. And, you know, the Venona papers in the 1990s that finally got released, the KGB papers, we now see that there's far more infiltrating in our government than he had actually thought there were. So maybe the way he went about it was, you know, somewhat obnoxious and ignorant. But, you know, I just didn't have much interest to see it, but I'm going to see it, you know, because I try to see all the Oscar nominations. I just haven't seen it yet.
What about Munich?
Saw Munich. Munich was a very, I thought it was a well-told tale. I think that it was also another subversive piece of political viewpoint that basically tried, you know, it's the story of the retribution that Israel took on the killers of the Israeli athletes that were killed by the Palestinians in, I can't remember which Olympics it was, but, you know, back in the 70s or whatever. And this is the story of how Israel went after the killers who plotted their deaths, and they eliminated them through the years using secret assassins. And the story is about how the lead assassin basically begins seeing it as a holy cause, but as the story goes on and he gets deeper into it, he starts to believe that it's not just, and it just begets more violence, and it's just revenge, and it's not justice. And so he concludes that Israel, you know, was wrong in seeking out these murderous, cowardice terrorists and killing them. And so, consequently, it's got a lot of conservatives up in an uproar, not the least of which are people who've actually written books on the topic and have clearly indicated those who actually were involved in killing of the terrorists and say, no, there was no, I had no guilt about killing them. It was a holy cause, and it was just. Because it is just, as Dennis Prager said, it's, you know, yes, killing people, even if they're guilty, can affect you in somewhat negative way. But in the end of the day, it's a just thing to do to kill people who deserve to die. And so, consequently, that's something that the movie never deals with, about the justice of that. It just assumes that, you know, killing just leads to more killing, and it's sort of the blame. It's always the blame shifting. It's blaming the evil on the victims, you know. It's why are the terrorists like this? Well, the terrorists were made into terrorists because of Israel. You know, rather than realize, well, wait a minute, terrorism is evil and wrong, and what about the wrongness of that, you know? And so consequently, you know, again, this is a season of highly politically charged movies, and I didn't care for the politics of it, but I thought it was a well-told story, though.
Okay, you mentioned a few minutes ago that Cinderella Man should have been on Best Picture list, but was not. Why so? And then are there any others that you would like to have seen get the nod for Best Picture?
Off the top of my head, that's the only one that I can think of. You know, maybe if I was able to look on my website and see the other movies. But
why Cinderella Man?
Well, you know, I think Cinderella Man was a powerful true story about Jim Braddock, a famous boxer back in the days of the Depression, and his struggles to, he's sort of an older guy and a little bit over the hill, but he's deeply determined to provide for his family through boxing. And so it's all about them struggling through the Depression and such, and it's just a movie of strong, powerful family values and moral values that you just don't see. A man who's willing to, in the midst of the Depression, they're starving, his kid steals a salami, and he scolds the kid and tells the kid to go back and apologize and bring the salami back. I mean, there's a man of virtue, honor, and dignity that is what we need in America. And I think it's really an American myth, the story is. You know, it's a strong American myth of, you know, the individual who provides for his family against all odds. He believes and fights, you know, fights for the, you know, the excellence and quality of what he really believes in. And in the end, he at least struggles and makes it through, you know. So I think that it powerfully resonates with America. I don't know why it didn't do well. I honestly don't. It should have.
Is it just that Russell Crowe has gotten so many Oscar nominations, people are kind of tired of saying, let's give him another one?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know.
Brian Goodow is a screenwriter in Southern California and author of the book Hollywood Worldviews, Watching Films with Wisdom and Discernment. You can read his movie blog on the web at Godawa.com. It's Godawa.com, Godawa.com. Brian, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks for having me, Ted.
All right, second hour of the program is our sermon review, as we usually do. We'll apply our three-part diagnostic. The preacher this time, you know, I was kind of hoping for Victoria Osteen this time, but it didn't happen. Joel preaching on Sunday at Lakewood Church in Houston, Texas, preaching on improving your self-esteem. He has a very simple recipe for improving your self-esteem. And I will say in advance, correct me if I'm wrong, but let's listen to the sermon and do the sermon review. But I think this is Joel Osteen showing his word faith roots more than he usually does. Most of the time, the word faith is the undercurrent, the name it and the claim it, the positive versus negative confession is there, but very, very subtle in Osteen's preaching, sounding a lot more like his dad, John, in this sermon. Although, it's classic Joel. He does mention Jesus once. Really. I want you to listen for it. In fact, that's the first part of our diagnostic. Listen for Jesus. How often is he mentioned? If he's mentioned, is he the subject of the verbs? And if he's mentioned and is the subject of the verbs, what are those verbs? What is it that Joel will be telling us Jesus has done, is doing, will do for us sinners? Oh, also listen for that. Sin. That's one thing that's conspicuously absent in much of Joel's preaching. Listen for that as well. When we come back, we'll review Joel Osteen's sermon from Sunday on improving your self-esteem.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.